Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live, Saturdays from 9 to noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio 102.7 FM in BC, Canada. For more information, check out www.vcn.bc.ca/redeye. Here's Jane Williams.
The place is Sudbury, the metal is nickel, the company is Falconbridge, and the union is Mine Mill Canadian Auto Workers Local 598. The strike started in midsummer. On the line from his home in Sudbury to explain the background and discuss the stakes of this strike is Mick Lowe. He is an author and labor journalist. Hello, Mick.
Good morning.
Now, Local 598, I hear, is a union with a very proud history. Could you outline that history for us?
Yes, I can. It is unique, actually, in the annals of Canadian labor for this reason. It is the last surviving local of the Western Federation of Miners, which will be known to some of your listeners because it had a strong base as well in British Columbia. The WFM goes back to 1893, May, actually, of 1893, and it was formed as one of the earliest industrial unions on the continent to represent hard rock miners in the American and Canadian West. Some of your listeners will have heard of Big Bill Haywood or the famous songwriter Joe Hill. They were both products of the WFM, and the Wobblies, the International Workers of the World, is another outgrowth of the Western Fed. In 1916, it changed its name to the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers. And in the early 40s, Local 598 was finally chartered here in Sudbury, principally at Inco, the other big nickel-producing company. But during the war and during much of the 1950s, Local 598, which represented the production and maintenance workers both at Inco and at Falconbridge, was the largest local union in North America. It had all 15 and sometimes as many as 20,000 members. It was, as one local, as large and as powerful as many whole unions are today.
And now it's the Mine Mill Canadian Auto Workers. How did that come about?
Well, it's a long and tortured history. In the 1960s, in the early 60s, well, let me jump back to the 50s in the McCarthy era. Of course, there were communist, anti-communist witch hunts going on across the continent, and Mine Mill was a major target. It was alleged that the union, and it was a very proud and very combative organization, and had undergone a period of number of periods of persecution in its history. But in the 50s, it was accused of having a communist leadership. And one by one, its locals were extinguished. They were raided by the United Steelworkers of America, which had the backing of the AFL-CIO, the American State Department, the CIA. One by one, raided the locals of Mine Mill, first in the U.S. and then in Canada, starting in the West and kind of moving east. Until in the early 60s, Local 598, which was really the powerhouse of the whole Mine Mill, was raided by the steelworkers here in Sudbury. It was a bitter struggle that lasted for a couple of years. It divided brother against brother, father against son. It was a condition of near civil war. There were riots. Blood was shed. No one was ever killed. There were bombings. It was quite a time. It really divided the community and divided the workers of Sudbury. In the end, the steelworkers won by the narrowest of margin. Out of something like 14,000 votes cast, the steelworkers won by 8 votes, sort of like the American presidential election we've just witnessed. But at Falconbridge, the workers voted to remain loyal to Mine Mill. So 598 dwindled from this massive, powerful trade union local down to a kind of a rump that represented only about 3,000 workers at Falconbridge. Local 6,500 of the steelworkers came in at Inco. Both these organizations still exist today. Local 6,500 of the steelworkers has about 3,500 members at Inco, and 598 has about 1,250 workers at Falconbridge. Of course, we've had downsizing along with everybody else. In 1993, I and a number of Sudburians, people from all over Canada and the United States actually, gathered at the Mine Mill Hall, a very historic place here in Sudbury, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Western Federation of Miners, which was in Butte, Montana, May 15th, 1893. But we were present on that night, 100 years later, to the night when the Western Fed had been formed in the last remaining union hall of that tradition. The next day, the members of the local voted to join the Canadian Auto Workers, the CAW. So what we now have is Mine Mill Local 598, as you correctly said, Mine Mill slash CAW. That, in a nutshell, that's the shortest version, long-winded as it was, that I can give you of this history.
Oh, no, it's very interesting history. So they're really kind of a proud union. And then on the other side is Noranda. Can you? Noranda's a huge corporation. How big is it?
Well, it is. It's actually, there's a triad of Canadian capital involved here. And I guess we'll start with the largest, which is Edper Brascan. It's a $10 billion Canadian enterprise that contains a number of branches within it. A chief within it is another huge company, Noranda, which is a mining company. And within Noranda, you have Falconbridge. So it's like a big fish being eaten by a still larger one, in turn eaten by a yet larger one. So these 1,250 workers at Mine Mill here in Sudbury, they're, you know, fairly small potatoes in the overall scheme of things, is now taking on this huge concentration of Canadian capital in Edper Brascan, Quay Noranda, Quay Falconbridge.
Now, the company pushed the workers to strike by demanding concessions in a new contract, and the CAW has said that it doesn't negotiate concessions. What did the company want to take away from the workers' previous gains?
Well, the 1st of August is when the strike started, and the company offer that was on the table at that juncture included some 80 takeaways, really gutting contract language. Interestingly enough, they offered the Inco pattern settlement in terms of money. And that was acceptable to the workers at Mine Mill. So really, money is not the issue here. What is at issue, I think, fundamentally, is ideology. This is a company that in the first 6 months of last year had earned $235 million Canadian in profit. That's Falconbridge. They were well on their way to earning $500 million in pure profit for the year 2000, which would have been a record far and away for any Canadian nickel company in the history of the industry, which goes back more than 100 years. That's not going to happen now. We don't know what their profit figure will be. It should be announced next week. But they were making huge profits, record profits, and yet they had the gall to turn around and demand takeaways, serious takeaways, of their workers. And, you know, you can understand this at a time if a company is losing money or if it's about to go bankrupt, that they may come to the union and say, well, look, we'd like to renegotiate and gain some concessions here to help us stay afloat. But here you had a company that was in the middle of a stellar banner year, and yet they wanted not to share with their workers, but to take stuff away from the workers, and that just wasn't on.
Now, the company's also been using scabs, and I understand that this is something very unusual for Sudbury.
That's right. Mine Mill Local 598 was chartered in 1944, so we've had a continuous union history here, 56, 57 years. There have been a certain number of strikes, but never before in the history of the union movement in Sudbury has one of the big two nickel companies attempted to scab a legal strike. This really was something new under the sun, and it took everyone by surprise. We're talking hard rock miners here, and smeltermen and mill workers, for the most part 90-95% male, increasingly numbers of women though, so that's a good thing, but we're talking very, very tough individuals. And the notion that somehow you could run scabs through their picket lines was just anathema. And we all thought, well, war would break out if that were to happen. So everyone was taken off guard by this really audacious move by Falconbridge and Noranda to try to run some scabs through the picket lines in order to maintain a minimal level of production in the smelter.
And how did the workers respond when that happened?
Well, first of all, the company armed itself with some 200, an estimated 200 paramilitaries, or kind of a private army that they brought into town, all from the outside, to kind of protect the plant gates, to protect the vehicles as they were moving through the picket lines, to videotape constantly the activities of the strikers on the picket lines and so on, and to intimidate and provoke the strikers. But the long and the short of it is the SCABS did go through, along with the office and technical staff, who are steelworkers union members and working with a contract, and supervisors. So as a group, they kind of screened one another, the legitimates and the illegitimates, so you really couldn't keep a count, a head count of who was what and who was on first. And they did manage to get the smelter up and running to a certain degree. There was smoke coming out of the smelter stack, highly visible throughout the Sudbury district, and really anathema, really an unthinkable thing that in the middle of a strike there would be smoke coming from a smelter stack. The symbolism was just horrendous for the entire community.
Now, the product of the smelting was then sent to Norway, and I understand that there was a support strike in Norway.
That's right. The ore is not refined here in Sudbury. It's smelted here, but for refining, the finishing phase of production, it is and always has been shipped to a refinery in Norway, which is also part of Falconbridge. Those workers there are unionized. And they at first, this is interesting, they at first had a very hard time understanding what a scab even was. And then they had a hard time understanding how such a thing could be legal in a civilized country, that when you have a group of workers who are on strike legitimately, how could it conceivably be lawful that you would let people who weren't in the union go in and do their work? So that was the first thing that the Canadians had to explain, was how this could happen. And of course, the Harris government here in Ontario that had reversed the anti-scab law of the NDP government previously, really inviting employers to do this kind of thing in the event of a legal strike. So we explained all of this to the workers in Norway, largely via email, and eventually they came around to the notion that they should go on strike in sympathy. Globalization working for the workers for once, and they did go on strike for about 5 days in November, and very, very helpful, terrific boost to the morale of the people here in Sudbury, of course.
Oh, that's great. Now, I understand that you had a run-in with what you call the paramilitaries, the private army there, the 200 people brought in to police the strike?
Well, I did, yes. I and a friend, Stuart Cryer, who's a videographer, have been shooting some video off and on of the strike as it's gone on, with the notion maybe of making a small documentary or something at some point. We thought that it would be very important. Video has really become a weapon in this war because these paramilitaries, called AccuFacts, are constantly videotaping the activities of the strikers. So we thought we would go and videotape these paramilitaries, videotaping everybody else. So on the morning of December 13th, Stuart and I kind of crossed over no man's land between the two lines and just walked up very slowly and visibly, but with our video camera rolling, to the paramilitaries. And sure enough, they had their cameras trained on us, and they videotaped us while we were videotaping them, videotaping us. And the long and the short of it was, they really didn't like having their pictures taken. We were simply doing what they'd been doing to Sudbarians here for months on end, but when we did it to them, they called the police.
So you got arrested?
We were arrested. We were both charged with trespassing, and Stuart was charged with common assault. We have the whole incident on tape. It all lasted about a minute. They told us we were trespassing. We said, oh, sorry, where's the property line? They pointed it out. We were starting to move back. And the next thing we knew, they claimed that Stuart had assaulted them and basically detained us, kind of surrounded us physically and kept us there while they phoned the Sudbury Regional Police, who came and eventually arrested us and handcuffed us and carted us off to the police station in the back of a police cruiser.
Now, I understand that you were talking union to them while this was going on.
Well, that's the whole story, is that these guys don't give interviews. They're extremely camera shy, extremely mic shy. They're not really proud people. And they know that they don't belong here, and they know that there's a tremendous amount of hostility towards them in this community, which is a labor town, of course. So I kind of think they must have felt like General Custer at the Little Bighorn just when he saw the first couple of eagle feathers coming up over the rise. They know that they're in a world of trouble here. So they won't talk to journalists. They won't answer questions. So while we were being surrounded, being detained, I had about 15 minutes that I could talk to them. And I did. I talked to Blue Streak, and that was a bitterly cold morning, and I was doing jumping jacks, and I told them that I understood that they were working for about $11 an hour, and it was very cold out, and that somewhere, somebody was sitting in a nice warm office making a profit off their labor, and that was a sure sign that they needed a union. And I had cards in my back pocket, and we were all willing to let bygones be bygones and sign them to the union, and on like that, being very careful to establish eye contact with each and every one of them at some point. And I've got quite a wide range of facial expressions, but not a word, not a peep. Told them they weren't having much fun either. They're a very, very sober bunch of guys, very serious. I realized later what it is they were scared to death. To be here, I think they were even scared of Stuart and I, and I know they were scared of our camera and having their faces put on tape and possibly their identities revealed. So it was a very glum situation, and the fact is they weren't having near as much fun as the guys down on the picket line. They weren't making so much money, but they didn't have too much to say to me at that point.
Now, quickly, we have to go, but I wanted to ask you what the prospects are for the settlement of the strike.
Well, I'm sorry to say that they resumed talking on Monday last for the first time since the beginning of September. Talks lasted 3 days and then broke off again on Wednesday. With both sides seemed to be entrenched in the same positions they were at in October. So at this point, it doesn't look good.
Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Mick.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Mick Lowe in Sudbury. Mick is a Sudbury columnist, labor journalist, and author who's written about Canada's nickel industry since 1974. His latest book is Premature Bonanza, Standoff at Voisey's Bay, published by Between the Lines.
Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live, Saturdays from 9 to noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM in BC, Canada. For more information, check out www.vcn.bc.ca/redeye.